We'll pipe in the June 3, 2011 rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, this is The Rain Report, available as a free weekly download and podcast from therainreport.com. I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK. In our second excerpt from the 2011 Dayton Hamvention Forums, we'll bring you our second segment from the FCC Forum, a standing room only event each year at the Hamvention. This week we feature William Cross, W3TN, who works in the Mobility Division in the Commission's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. Cross discusses FCC decisions that have affected amateur service in the past year, along with current open proceedings.
What I want to talk about is some of the Commission decisions that the regulatory end of it, that the past year that the Commission has made, that has affected the amateur service. I'm briefly going to mention the proceedings and what the Commission decided, and I also want to mention a couple of open proceedings. The first one is a proceeding that is of great interest to many of you, and it tends to be very important in amateur radio, and that is call signs. We had a docket that was looking at changing the rules that applied to the vanity call sign system. The goal of the proceeding was to make the system more equitable and efficient. As many of you know, vanity call signs have been available to you since 1996. It's kind of hard to imagine. It's 15 years old already. And over 80,000 of you have received vanity call signs. As soon as the system got started in 1996, there were immediate requests to change various aspects of it, adjust certain rules because you all saw the potential for gaming the system. And sure enough, a few of your brethren did game the system. So we got around to it, and again, it came out to kind of what do you want? How do you want the system changed? What the Commission decided in this proceeding was that we established a 30-day hold period before you could apply for a call sign that had been assigned to a licensee that died more than 23 months before we received a request for cancellation. What had been happening with the vanity call sign system was that the licenses are 10-year licenses. So someone would die, it would not become generally known that they had died, and then someone who wanted the call sign would wait until after the 2-year period had run, or 2 years after they had died, and they would send us a request for cancellation and immediately with it an application for the call sign. So they would get the call sign because we would cancel it based on the date of death. 2 years later, it was assignable. Their application was the only application in line, and they got it. This was perceived by most of you as being kind of unfair. So what we did was we said, okay, if the request for cancellation is received more than 23 months after a person has died, what we will do is we will establish a 30-day hold period. This allows the availability of a desirable call sign to become known, and it provides an opportunity for other licensees to apply for the call sign. The exceptions that allow former holders of a call sign, relatives of a deceased former holder, or just certain relatives, and clubs which the deceased former holder was a member of, can still apply for the call sign during the 2-year hold period. Another issue that had come up was the question of in-laws. The rule only specified that in-laws were available to get a deceased licensee's call sign. It didn't specify who the in-laws were. This resulted in a tremendous amount of creativity. Some of the relationships for in-laws that we heard about just brought tears to your eyes. Now, those tears only occurred when a 1x2 was involved. So the rules were changed to specify who an in-law is for purposes of this relative of a former holder now deceased exception. What the Commission did was it defined an in-law. It turned out it was actually fairly easy. It turns out Black's Law Dictionary, which is kind of like a telephone book that lawyers drool over, has a pretty good definition of an in-law in it. What we used was what's really called a first-degree relative, was the level of in-laws. So it's basically the parents or the siblings of a licensee's spouse, the spouse of a licensee's siblings or children, or the spouse of a licensee's spouse's siblings. Now, the complete list is in Section 97.3. Believe it or not, this is a much smaller list of your relatives than it was before, but big Irish families still have an advantage. And by the way, I'm half Irish. The vanity call sign report and order also limited clubs to holding one vanity call sign on a going forward basis. If you look in the databases, and there's a number of them out there, and if you search, for instance, on trustees call signs, you'll see that there's some trustees that have 5, 10, 20 clubs, and they have a bunch of different vanity call signs. You'll also see that some clubs have a lot of different call signs. Primary station licenses, which each one of us individually hold, we're limited to one call sign. That's all we can have. So this kind of equalized the situation between clubs and individuals, where on a going forward basis, clubs can hold only one vanity call sign. Now, clubs that currently hold more than one vanity call sign are not allowed to obtain any more vanity call signs. So we close that loophole, but they can renew or modify their existing call signs. Clubs that need a lot of call signs, for example, the clubs that have the D-Star repeater systems, apparently the way that was set up by the developer of the system was that each station has to have its own call sign. So some clubs came in and said, gee, we have these D-Star systems, we need 35 call signs because we have to have one for each station. Okay, they can get as many sequentially issued call signs as they need. They can still only have one vanity call sign, but they can get as many sequentially issued ones as they need. These are the 2x3 call signs that are just, you know, spit out by the computer. The ARRL has filed a petition for reconsideration of this decision. It's asking for clarification of one of the rules that were adopted. I anticipate the commission will address the petition later this year. The second report and order, the second decision that actually came out, was the spread spectrum power decision. This proceeding concerned the power limits for stations that transmit spread spectrum communications. The commission made two changes there. It decided to eliminate the automatic power control requirement that had been in the rules, and it limited stations transmitting spread spectrum emissions to a maximum power of 10 watts. So that got simplified for you considerably.
You're listening to an excerpt from a talk given at the 2011 Dayton Hamvention FCC Forum by William Cross, W3TN, who works in the Mobility Division in the Commission's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. We'll conclude his remarks in a moment. This is the RAN Report, the weekly production of the Radio Amateur Information Network.
The third decision was the one that involved prohibited communications and specifically communications transmitted on behalf of an employer. This decision added another exception to the prohibited communications rules. The issue had been emergency communications and employees transmitting messages on behalf of their employer. The commission decided that for an emergency or disaster test or drill that is government sponsored, such as these big events, I know many times in states and counties you have county government sponsored or state government-sponsored events. The decision there was that the licensee may participate on behalf of an employer for the duration and scope of the test or drill, including operational testing immediately prior to the test or drill. For a test or drill that is not government-sponsored, this is sometimes companies or other entities will be required to have a test or drill, like an evacuation drill or something, but it's not government-sponsored. There, a licensee may participate, but is limited to a total time of 1 hour per week, except that no more than twice in any calendar year, these tests may be conducted for a period not to exceed 72 hours. You probably noticed that these time limits are the same limits we use for the RACES tests and drills. We picked that so there would be a limit for the non-government sponsored stuff, but it's also a limit that we've never had complaints about, and seems to have met your needs for many, many years. I mentioned RACES. There was also a change to RACES. All RACES stations have now expired. You didn't notice? Maybe that was because all the RACES station license authorized was a call sign. You may have noticed that in the vanity call sign report and order, the commission amended Part 97 to remove references to RACES station licenses. Now, RACES is still there in the rules, and it's still there for a civil defense organization if they want to establish a RACES group and to certify and enroll licensees in it. If a civil defense organization wants to take on this headache, the restrictions on the stations and amateur station registered with it may communicate with are still there too. But Section 97.407, which is the RACI's rules, became a tremendously simpler rule with the removal of the RACI's station licenses. We have a couple of open proceedings right now, too. Our Office of Managing Director handles the fees and the money end of the commission. It has proposed that the fee for a vanity call sign will increase to $14.20. The current fee is $13.30. If adopted, the fee usually is charged in late summer or early fall. Our Office of Engineering and Technology also has two proceedings that affect you. One of them is a proceeding that concerns the five channels that make up your 60-meter band. The proposal is to make the 60-meter band more useful to you all while making sure the primary users, which are primarily government stations, can also use the channels. I expect that a decision in this docket will be coming out later this year. And OET also has a proceeding to address the Court of Appeals remand of the rules that apply to BPL. I have no idea what the schedule for that is. You may have still heard about the National Broadband Plan. The plan came out with great fanfare last year. As usual, the fanfare dies down and the hard work starts. The National Broadband Plan, what they're looking for is reallocating 500 megahertz of spectrum to mobile broadband over the next 10 years. And this plan is getting attention on Capitol Hill and at the commission. Part of that seems to be an inventory of spectrum, both federal and non-federal. Bills mandating this inventory have been introduced in Congress. The goal is to find spectrum that can be used for the National Broadband Plan. Generally, what is being looked for is primarily under 3 gigahertz, and it's spectrum in large blocks. The plan is to auction the spectrum off and use it for commercial services, probably something similar to the cell phone service today, but at greater bandwidths. What people seem to want is mobile video, the type of application that Microsoft may have had in mind when it recently bought Skype. Federal agencies are examining their spectrum to see if it is being used as efficiently as possible. Your bands below 225 megahertz do not appear to be of much interest for the National Broadband Plan because they are narrow. Generally, they're 4 megahertz or less in bandwidth, and the propagation on them is too long. 902 to 928 is a nice wideband, but it has an awful lot of consumer devices in it, which may cause interference to mobile devices, particularly handheld devices. There are other bands that the amateur services allocated that may be of use for the National Broadband Plan. The 9-centimeter band is 200 megahertz wide. The 13-centimeter band, although it's a split band, covers 150 megahertz. Your 5-centimeter band is 275 megahertz wide. These bands are possibilities, particularly if they're not other users on it, or the other users could be moved, and especially if they are paired with other spectrum. Now, we also have a bill pending on the Hill. This is H.R. 607 that you've read an awful lot about. This is the Broadband for First Responders Act of 2011 that was introduced in the House of Representatives. The bill requires a swap of auctionable spectrum, including the 420 to 440 megahertz band, as part of a process of providing additional spectrum above 7 megahertz for an interoperable broadband network for first responders. Commercial interests such as the land mobile community, which already has spectrum adjacent to you at 450 to 470 megahertz, are looking for additional spectrum, and that could be a likely bidder on the 420 to 440 megahertz band. There's been a lot of back and forth and lobbying on this bill so far. My understanding is it's in one of the House committees. What becomes of the bill will have to be seen, but it is something to watch in the future. Now, we have two petitions that are also awaiting action at the commission. The first is from the ARRL. It asks that we revise the rules so that certain TDMA equipment in use can be used legally. Apparently, a number of people have bought and put on the air TDMA systems that are not allowed under the rules, so they are asking that the rules be changed. The second petition is from the Anchorage Volunteer Examiner Coordinator. It is asking that we allow the VECs to give an examinee credit for any examination element the examinee has previously passed. This would help individuals who have allowed their licenses to expire and to go beyond the 2-year grace period during which they could be renewed. It would help them become relicensed.
This concludes our excerpts from the 2011 Dayton Hamvention FCC Forum. This week we featured William Cross, W3TN, who works in the Mobility Division in the Commission's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. The RAIN Report is copyright 1990-2011. RAIN, all rights reserved. Now for RAIN's founder and producer, Hap Pauly, KC9RP, I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK, bidding each of you a very 73 from all of us at RAIN, the Radio Amateur Information Network. www.therainreport.com